Beautiful to be with you all. And today we are continuing with the discussion on 10 perfections or paramis. This is, I believe, fourth in the series we're going to be discussing today. For those of you who weren't here for the first three, I will do it like a recap. The paramis are the list of perfections in the insight tradition or Theravada tradition. There is 10 of them. In the Mahayana tradition, there's six of them. Nowhere Buddha explicitly taught these 10 things as a list, but he covered all these 10 things extensively in all of his teachings. Because all of his teachings fundamentally is around four noble truths. And the fourth noble truth leading to the Eightfold Path. That is the core of all of Buddhist teachings. That's why we call the four noble truths as sometimes elephant footprint, wherein all the animal's footprint can fit into the footprint of an elephant, right? That is most encompassing. And we don't, as a Buddhist, we don't have commandments, we don't have edicts, we don't have any of those rules. However, we have those four truths. And there was no hesitation in them. There was nothing like there may be suffering in life. He said there is suffering in life. There's a sense of surety. And the reason for suffering is clinging. And the way to end suffering is letting go of clinging. The path that leads to letting go is the Eightfold Path. And that was Buddha's first teaching. In the Dharmachakra Pravartana Sutta, the very first sermon he gave at Sarnath, the deer park, after he got enlightened. And after that, I feel like the rest of his teachings were like Q&A sessions all over. He traveled around most parts of India. And that's why in the suttas, you always say it's not like what Buddha said. It was compiled a few years, many years after his passing away. And the first two few words in every sutta is always, thus I have heard. This is people who are collecting the suttas of Buddha's teachings into a canon, their recollection and what is serving as everything they know. So the paramis, the key verb associated with parami is cultivation. We cultivate this in order to experience our Eightfold Path journey. Right? And the 10 in the Theravada tradition are generosity, virtue, wisdom, renunciation, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. Some of these come in the other list too, like seven factors of awakening. If you go to Brahma Viharas or heavenly abodes, you'll find loving kindness and equanimity there. There's no particular reason they are in this order. I asked Gil the same question, our teacher from IMC. However, it can be justified in this order. The list in Mahayana doesn't even align with this list. They put wisdom at the end. So, why they become is all of our Buddhist teaching centered around how do we not fall or trapped into greed, hatred, and delusion. And we'll go into that a little bit later. But cultivation of paramis is to protect us, not get trapped by greed, hatred, and delusion. That's a common aspect of every parami. That's where we started from a few months ago when we introduced the topic. And we talked about generosity. In the Western world, particularly when you use word generosity, immediately thought of donations and monetary contribution comes to mind. That's how we are conditioned. But generosity can be any number of things, generosity of time, generosity of care, generosity of attention, generosity of listening, generosity of thanking people without being judgmental. We can bring generosity in so many ways that really bonds us with the other beings in very, very pleasant way. Okay. So that's how the scope of generosity is defined. I also mentioned in the Eastern tradition, particularly the Thai tradition and Burmese tradition, which is the roots of a lot of the Theravada teachers, when somebody joins a sangha there, whether not necessarily in the monastic tradition, but also in the lay tradition, before they teach you meditation, they ask you to serve the community, generosity of service. Clean this place up, arrange everyone's shoes. I attended a Burmese center here in San Jose, Lucretia Avenue, Tathagata Meditation Center. I attended retreats there too. And there you see that generosity of service in action for everyone who comes there is implicitly given a task. So we follow that in retreats. I check in our bags when we are checking into retreat. Welcome, thank you. You're registered. This is your yogi job right off the bat. Okay, that includes cutting vegetables, including onions. No exceptions. Right? So we get that list. It's really beautiful too, how that practiced in the retreats. And the other aspect of paramis, why we are cultivating them, is to protect ourselves in the roles we take. We all recognize we are not the same person all the time. There's a different persona that comes in. We are a parent. When my kids were young, they're grown up. The constant thoughts in my head is around their safety issues, their learning issues, their future issues. They never leave your mind. And then you still have your job, you still have your deadline, you are a persona of an employee of a company that has its own set of, right? And if you don't have the tools, these things lead to suffering in the Buddhist tradition or unsettled nature of the mind, however you want to define that, right? And that's where this cultivation comes in. And we went into the topic of virtue. What does virtue mean? In the Eightfold Path, the right action, right speech, and right livelihood were bucketed as virtue steps. Right view and right intention are the wisdom steps. Right mindfulness, right concentration are under concentration steps. Right? There's a way all of Buddhist teachings or the Eightfold Path is bucketed into these three topics. So virtue plays a very big role there. So last month we talked about wisdom as a step. Wisdom is not about intelligence. That's what I emphasize. Wisdom has a role for the heart as much as it is for the mind. How do you embrace kindness and compassion in the most wise way, caring for yourself, caring for others, caring for yourself and others, which, by the way, is the most common refrain in all of Buddhist teachings. Buddha never advocated compromise yourself so that you can be of service to others. That was never, I've never seen it expressed that way. That's how we address the wisdom step. So today I want to connect to renunciation. In the normal language, and anytime you hear the word renunciation, perhaps the first thought comes up is giving up something. What am I giving up? In Buddhist context, that's not necessarily the case. That's what I want to emphasize. There's one thing I want to take away from this Dharma talk is knowing what Buddhist teaching says. Renunciation is not necessarily or specifically giving up. This is not about what I call deprivation. We're not depriving ourselves of anything. Right? So it's the way it is defined and positioned in many of the ways when Buddha referred to is renunciation is in the context of freeing our heart. How do you find that open-heartedness, kind-heartedness, compassionate-heartedness, and what role can renunciation play for them? That's different than saying that, let's start to compile a list and check it off one by one what we can give up. No, I didn't come across any such teaching. And in Pali, the renunciation is called nekama, is the fine aspect, subtle aspect of letting go, seeking simplicity, and not giving up desire, but reorienting desire. I'm going to expand on it a little bit more. In our path, when you say we are in the Eightfold Path or we are in the Buddhist path, we are protecting, like I said, from the effects of three poisons, namely greed, hatred, and delusion. And Buddha frames, this path has to be a path of ease. Don't take it as a slog or a punishment, you know? So in terms of greed, hatred, and delusion, I was reading one of Gill's articles recently, and he succinctly summarized this. I'm going to use that as a basis for this discussion. And Gill defined greed as greed encompasses craving, clinging, attachment, longing, and lusting. Essentially, any form of desperate wanting or grasping. Emphasize the word wanting and grasping. In the context of renunciation, we are applying the wisdom and examining the word wanting and grasping. We are renunciating or easing or letting go that wanting or grasping. It's not the object of the desire, but the wanting or grasping nature we may have for that object. Right? And that renunciation here is emphasized in the context of that stickiness we have. The default mode network says, if only I did this, I will be relaxed. Mindset. Okay. And that is, you know, in an extreme sense, you can call it addictive tendencies, addictive behaviors. Hatred, according to Gill, includes hostility, malice, antagonism, irritability, cantankerousness, any form of aversion, anger, or rejection. And he even included here irritability. Hatred doesn't have to be a much, much larger, deeply agitating mental state. Even a minor irritability, Gill defined it in the context of hatred. In the context of renunciation, emphasis here is our association or construction of a view of an incident or a person that's causing that irritability. Can we let go of that construction? Can we renunciate that construction or the view? How do we feel if we let go, if we renunciate that construction of the view? Do we experience some ease? I would say yes. Right? And the third poison, delusion, covers ignorance, confusion, bewilderment, irrationality, heartlessness, essentially being out of touch with reality or acting without wisdom. That's Gill's definition. In the context of renunciation, it frees us from wholesome thinking. When we are confused, the wholesome thoughts don't easily come. Yeah? And it happens quite often. We may not even notice it. And renunciation is applying our wisdom, allowing us to see past that confusion. And Gillard continues, These three poisons often operate beneath the surface of our awareness. Even when we can observe them in our thoughts and behavior, part of that influence may remain hidden from ordinary perception. That's why renunciation is an inner act, not merely externally giving up on things. So there's subconscious and then there's unconscious, which we hardly pay attention to on a regular basis. I just recently finished reading Carl Jung's biography, Memory Streams, great book, right? And his whole construct of unconscious is through dreams. So this guy sleeps and gets up, is right next to his bed is a book. He writes in as much detail about his dreams as possible and connects the dreams to his unconscious. That is the singular achievement in his life of his whole psychological philosophy. And he put so much effort into documenting his dreams. His biography, he says, I don't want to narrate my biography in the context of places where I've been to, where I grew up, who my friends are. I want to give you in the context of how my thought process evolved. It's a biography of his thinking. Right? It was fascinating to read. Anyway, coming back to renunciation. Other way to look at renunciation, particularly in the Dharma path for us, is how are we opening up to Dharma and learning about Buddhist teachings and practicing Buddhist teaching? Scenario A, we read and learn. Scenario B, we read and learn in the context of what we already know. I get it. I know, right? And then we practice. Scenario C, can we renunciate our default thinking and allow for new thinking to grow? So in Zen, there is a parable. Zen is full of great stories, and this is one of them. So this story goes like this. On a particular day, a scholar comes to visit a Zen master. And the scholar says, I have come to ask you to teach me about Zen. And the story, it goes, soon it became obvious the scholar was full of his opinions and knowledge. He interrupted the master repeatedly with his own stories and failed to listen to what the master had to say. The master calmly suggested that they should have tea. So the master poured his guest a cup. The cup was filled, yet he kept pouring until the cup overflowed onto the table, onto the floor, finally onto the scholar's robes. The scholar got irritated and said, Stop, this cup is full already, can't you see? And the master replied, Exactly, you are like this cup, so full of ideas and nothing more will fit in. Come back to me with an empty cup, I'll teach you then. This is another context for renunciation, particularly for path of Dharma. Are we fitting in or are we making room for it? And this story reminds us why we need to stay humble. Humility is a gateway to renunciation. Although humility is not explicitly a parami, it is implicit in many of the paramis. And this has to be intentional, not because someone expects. This is not like sacrifice, the other word that we get confused with. Sacrifices are sometimes forced on us of situation in life. Last month, I was volunteering for Red Cross right here in Hillier Park in South San Jose. Our local state senator, Dave Cortese, couple of year hosts a multicultural fair. So Red Cross had a booth and they were looking for volunteers. I signed up. This particular one is for international humanitarian law. I said, what are they doing in San Jose? So we got trained previous night on Zoom what this booth was about, what we need to do. And this was about a connection service for refugees in Bay Area to connect with their loved ones who they have to leave behind in the war-torn countries. And here we are trying to take the names and put it in the database and connect them, and local volunteers in the war-torn countries go find the person and make the connection. That's the service. So I was surprised. We had more than a dozen people from Syrian refugees who came in into the booth and connected with us. Apparently, San Jose took 14,000 Syrian refugees to the war. I didn't know about that. There's one guy, he looked at it first, he was like, is this really happening? Is this a service you're offering? That was an enigma. Then we took his database, explained everything. And then I saw his face shift from enigma to hope. Who does he want to contact? When was the last time? What city he last saw them? And then I tried to become a chaplain, a little bit from volunteer. I excused myself from the booth and walked with this guy around the lake. And he was telling me he had less than 90 minutes to leave when the Red Cross truck came in, and they just left, leaving behind everything. No goodbyes, no connection to anyone. They moved to, first driven to Jordan, from there by plane, ended up in the US. And the word sacrifice doesn't even define this whole life situation unfolded for them in such a way. And they are piecing together and rebuilding their life. Yeah, they are very grateful for all the help they received in San Jose. It's amazing to see how wonderfully grateful they are, the big-hearted people. And they never forgot what they left behind. And this service gave them that hope. So coming back to renunciation, there is the three types of, call it the second noble truth, attachment or clinging, that we can apply the principles of renunciation too. One is renunciation of sense pleasures. It's not a moralistic rejection. That's an important differentiation. It's a cultivation of non-dependency. Just tried this last, it's been less than a month. When I'm at home, me and my phone shouldn't be in the same room. Right. So I tell people now, please send me email than text messages. I have a more disciplined time windows I set aside for emails. Your chances of me responding to email is that much better. Right? It's a struggle. Otherwise, your phone's constantly beeping, and sometimes it doesn't beep. You feel, am I missing something? Right? And this is. I was very concerned how much that thought, that sensation was lingering in me. I wanted to do something about that. In a way, there's a sutta in Majjhima Nikaya, Magandhiya Sutta. I won't go into the sutta itself. In the sutta, Buddha compares sensual pleasures to a leper's wound. And their relief comes from scratching, not even thinking about healing. Pretty gross comparison, but gets the point across. Right? And that is way to look at anything we feel. I want to read a book because I'm stressed out. Pause and examine, is that the best wholesome thing you can do for your situation at the time? Our default mode network says, I want to watch TV, or I want to read a book, or I want to watch a movie, whatever it may be. Nothing wrong with any of those, but is it a reactive tendency or is it a wise tendency? Have you explored other options? which means I'm willing to relinquish or renunciate whatever my default thoughts are, quick and reactive thoughts are. The second is renunciation of the unwholesome states, letting go of anger, jealousy, resentment, compulsive reactivity. This is a particular sutta, right? Nivarana sutta. Nivarana means to remove hindrances as obstacles to clarity. So when you have these tendencies, the first thing is your lenses are all fogged up and clear. In that state of mind, anything, any decision you make possibly fits into the delusion definition quite easily, mixed with dislike or hatred. Right? And there's a sutta towards the end, I'll touch on it, how Buddha explained to cultivate that state about how do you partition your thinking. That's a beautiful example he gives. I'll come to that. And the third type of renunciation, which is very pertinent in modern times, is renunciation of views, opinions, and ego. And particularly examine how much of our ego is present in our views and opinions. I read about this argument in one thing. We live in a culture where you not only need to be right, you want to prove the other guy wrong. How painful is that just to read that? Right? And take it from this context, I'm not even debating about the views and opinions. I'm asking about what does that inner feeling feel like at that moment to even go through that experience? Is it worth it? Right? And that's what we are renunciating. It's not like I'm not going to have opinions. It's not like I'm not going to have views. But the stickiness that drives the inner anger, inner causing inner instability, and that's what we are letting loose. So, in a nutshell, renunciation matters for us to be in the Dharmapada or bring this into our day-to-day living, because this chain we live in. Desire, clinging, dependency, stress. We got to break this chain somehow. Renunciation is a cultivation as a parami or a perfection to allow for breaking this chain. So now, to wrap up. So Buddha in his sutta says he had the similar issues, he said, right after enlightenment. So I thought, why don't I divide my thinking into two sorts? So RTS. This is Buddha speaking. So I made thinking imbued with sensuality, thinking imbued with ill will, and thinking imbued with harmfulness as one sort, and thinking imbued with renunciation, thinking imbued with non-ill will, and thinking imbued with harmlessness as another sort. This is MN19, Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta 19. And Buddha said, I abandoned the former, I pursued the latter. So this is the pause. This is the pause that we become less reactive and look for a wholesome way to look what is in front of us. So this is like a playbook he gave. Yeah, I can think this way, or I can lead my thoughts this way. And one of the critical tools that I personally practice a lot is writing reflections. And this has helped me a lot. because I can think myself through up to a certain point. When I put in paper reflection and come back and look at it, I can do something about it. That's what I found. That's my learning process. So one of the questions I framed is, what am I holding that I can put it aside? Every so often, I tend to hold on to certain things. And I know that I'm unsettled because of it. I can't get to the root of unsettledness unless I take this reflective exercise. That requires wisdom. And the other one that I think about is in the two major sutras for meditation that Buddha taught us. One is Anapanasati, the 16 steps of meditation practice. Other one is the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness. Okay. In Anapanasati, the second tetrad is about watching in our own meditation, desire and attachment, craving, raising, and fading away, raising, interfering with your concentration. There's a template there to use. And the third contemplative practice, which is very important, many of us do this regularly, that is our theme song at the end of our session here, is renunciation of ill will and goodwill. Renunciation of ill will through goodwill by practicing metta. And metta meditation is very powerful, especially in this environment we are in. Because the most important thing we need to guard ourselves again is negative thoughts, the corrosive thinking that's so easy. Right? And metta practice is a perfect antidote to that. So the last thing I want to emphasize is there is a word that can lead to cultivation of renunciation. That word is dispassion. We don't hear outside of spiritual circles that word often. Dispassion is a beautiful word. It's like almost something that dissolves the stickiness of a glue. Right? From I need it is from I need it to I would like to have it. It's okay if I don't have it. That transition making is what dispassion is about. And that's a beautiful word by itself to reflect on. Yeah. So to summarize, we are not working towards giving up on things by dispassion, by renunciation, right? It's not drastic. This is not sacrificing. This is largely applying wisdom with the singular purpose of finding that inner peace. That is the only reference that we have why we practice renunciation is it causing us harm? Is it causing us unsettledness? Is it costing us agitation? Then, yeah, bringing renunciation into your practice may offer some ease. So I want to end with Dhammapada, verse 290, from Gill's translation. If by giving up lesser happiness, one could experience greater happiness, a wise person would renounce the lesser to behold the greater. So there's a lot here. The first is for every occasion, he's asking us to examine opportunity cost, as we say in economics. What is the next best option we have? Right? And make the determination. Thank you. That's what I came prepared for. We have 12 minutes or so for Q&A. I didn't mention this in general. If you are inspired and if you are oriented towards generosity of donations, of the talk, I ask you to consider Insight World Aid, which is a nonprofit firm, Insight Meditation Center, which I run that organization. we use the 100% of the funds, 100% for right now, largely to hunger issues in Bay Area. We are starting to explore addressing hunger issues in other parts of the world as well through monetary donations to other countries. Very grateful for your service there. Thank you. Questions? Objections? Anyone on the Zoom?
Thank you, and for the
Thank you.
very beautiful topic today. I haven't attended the previous discussions.
The recordings must be on the website.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. At least this was very beautiful. Because while I was listening to this, I was waiting for you to say the tools, how to achieve the renunciation. It is easier understood in theory, but in practice, how can we do that?
Yeah.
And the three things you mentioned really were good. And I was also waiting to hear if dispassion is one of them, because in the Hindu tradition, there's a lot of dispassion, vairagya in
Yeah.
Sanskrit.
We call it viraga and Pali
Vairagya.
viraga. Yeah, in Sanskrit.
Adishankara mentioned, what cannot you achieve while looking at that,
Correct.
but by
Yeah.
practicing dispassion?
Thank you. Yeah.
One thing I was also thinking is there could be, this is particularly with the renunciating the sensory pleasures.
Yeah.
There could be things that a person tries all the ways and tools, but still
Yeah.
it can happen.
Yeah.
Is that then understood as karma or a fate
Yeah,
or
great
vasana?
question.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if you all heard the question. So there are some sensory things that come in we may not be able to renounce, and that could be karmic in nature. That, yeah. The way I personally have trained is not to intellectualize this topic. The cerebral approach has a point of diminishing return. You got to use your heart. Use the compassion as the lens through which you look at the situation. The cravings and sensoriness is largely mental things. That's how I feel. That sensitivity is because we trained over generations and years for us to be the problem-solving mind. The residual side effect of it is it's also the craving mind. Because it's outcome driven by nature. We conditioned it. We're less interested in enjoying the process than the outcome of the result. Whereas heart doesn't make that distinction. That's been my personal experience. Look, I'm not going to intellectually solve the problem wrong. This is not going to go. There are a thousand reasons it tells me today's raining, it's all the stuff. I don't want to go to the shelter in Redwood City. There are so many forces that come in. But I have to renunciate that thought at that point by putting my emphasis on what is my purpose at that time, why this particular activity is more meaningful and wholesome. Right? That's the dialogue between my mind and my heart. My brain and my heart, right? I go through that quite often. And it is not an automatic thing, it is a cultivated aspect. Thank
Thank you.
you. Anyone else? When you think about question, there is a five steps. If you broadly read Buddhist texts, I caught up on different pieces and formed this. Learning is a lot more than knowing. Realizing is a lot more than learning. Experiencing is a lot more than realizing. Making it part of your behavior is a lot more than experiencing. So the steps are knowing, learning, realizing, experiencing, making it part of your behavior. Right? And that's what it being, we use the word practice. There's no perfection here. There's no finals. Just keep practicing. If it's not this life, next life. If it's not next life, the next tens of lives, hundreds of lives. The practice continues on. And the knowing part has a lot of ego built into it. I, the knower. That's a trap. If I'm shifting, as you move further into learning to realizing, the role of ego diminishes if you observe very closely. And this process is when we use the word we are cultivating in Buddhist practice, and this is the process we're going through. Going to learning, to realizing, to experiencing, to making it part of our behavior. I'll probably do one or two more questions if you have it.
Hi, Ram. Yeah, thank you very much. This was really helpful. So you used the word pause at some point. And I think what I am coming to understand with most of the topics is this pause. And I heard it called a sacred pause in some other context, because I feel like that's the basis of any form of change. Because if you can take that sacred pause, that deep breath, then you create space to be able to make a different choice
Beautiful.
instead of just reacting to the situation.
Yeah.
So that was the part that I heard you say, the pause. I think that's the crux of it.
Thank you. That's a big part of our practice, right? We are socially driven to say that pause sounds awkward, Ram. This is not the time. We feel we all those stories will come in. It doesn't matter. We have to take the pause at the time for us to be fully present.
You mentioned about the 16 attributes of meditation.
16th, no, it's 16 steps
Steps.
Anapanasati. It's the mindfulness of breathing that put that heart. And the emphasis of that particular style practice was Buddha taught Rahula, his own son. And Rahula joined him and he wanted to go into this practice. What he taught is the 16th step Anapanasati that is broken into four tetrads. There are a lot of overlaps between that and four foundations of mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta. We must be approaching enough time for maybe one question.
I was wondering, especially with the like the sense of pleasures, especially this sleepy brain. Or for me, like my days are pretty unstructured right now. And in the mornings, what ends up getting me up is that I have appointments or whatever to go to. But if it's for my own sake, even if I feel like I've had enough rest, the sleepy brain is so powerful in this wanting comfort and how warm it is under the covers, especially as the weather gets colder. And so I guess I'm curious if you have any suggestions or recommendations. How do I have that pause when it's so automatic and so ingrained to be like, how do I go for this greater good, right? With like a better routine and going out for a walk or something. Yeah.
There are two phrases in Buddhism which is very important, which we haven't used it much most of our life. One is self-compassion, other one is self-care. And Buddha emphasized it about self-care, self-compassion throughout. And we each one of us have to figure out how to frame that. I want to use the word struggle in a most compassionate way, because we are conditioned to perform, conditioned to give. But when it comes to self-compassion and self-care, necessary actions don't easily come out. Right? And that is something I strongly encourage you to make it first a reflective activity and then a practical activity. third part is making it as a discipline to include it into your schedule. Right? It's not when you're stressed out, you think about self-compassion, self-care. Make that part of your routine. And I don't know how many people really reflectively think about going through that phase. And it's not so much with relief, that's one aspect of it. Other aspect is building capacity. Okay. For me, the work I do, a lot of them is heart-based, and I need that meditative practice for me to grow my capacity. In the beginning of this year, I made a decision in addition to my 2 sits in the morning, one day a week, I want to do 4 sits in the morning. I go to bed at 7:30 p.m. I get up at 2 a.m. Between 2 and 8 a.m., I'm doing a half-day retreat. Right? I needed that self-care. That is just amazing time I spend that I feel like I'm 50 years younger when I do that. Right? But I had to prioritize. I need to sacrifice certain things or renunciate certain things to fit into the schedule, and that needs to be part of the discipline. Then I look forward to it. It's no longer a chore. I don't think about getting up in the morning and all that stuff, but it is in my schedule, which doesn't interfere with anything else that I'm doing, except I'm presenting better myself in those situations. Right? My only ask is start with reflection, come up with practices, fit it into your schedule. And prioritize that.